Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. Every day, we are exposed to hundreds of hormone-disrupting chemicals. They're in our food, the water we drink, the clothes we wear, the products we put on our bodies, and countless other places. Today's guest, Dr. Leonardo Trasande, says endocrine-disrupting chemicals contribute to conditions that affect 99% of us. They scramble the basic and natural molecular signals our body use to maintain body temperature, metabolism, salt, sugar, and even sex. In his new book, Sicker, Fatter, Poor, The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future and What We Can Do About It, Dr. Leonardo Trasande notes that over 1,000 everyday chemicals can disrupt hormones and contribute to disease. The evidence is greatest for four categories of chemicals: flame retardants used in electronics, carpeting, and furniture, phthalates used in cosmetics, personal care products, and food packaging like cans, and bisphenols, or BPA, which are found in thermal paper receipts and aluminum cans, and pesticides used in agriculture. Over the years, we have done so many shows about how these chemicals affect our brains and bodies and the impacts of hormone-altering chemicals on children. In fact, just last week, we spoke with someone from the Environmental Working Group about their yearly Dirty Dozen list. They look at fruits and vegetables and pesticides on these and what effect they might have on our bodies. And you can find that show at yourcallradio.org. So what are some of the simple steps we can take to protect ourselves and our families to reduce our exposure to these hormone-disrupting chemicals? Dr. Leonardo Trasande is Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the NYU School of Medicine at NYU's Wagner School of Public Service. He serves on several national and international committees that study the impact of chemicals on children, and he leads one of 35 centers across the country as part of the National Institute of Health's Environmental Influences on Child Health Outcomes program. His new book is called Sicker, Fatter, Poorer, and Dr. Trasande joins us from his office in New York. Hi, Dr. Trasande. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to start off by talking first about your background. In your book, you write that your training began at Harvard College and then Harvard Medical School, and you enrolled at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, where you really dove deep into health policy and economics. And then soon after, you completed your pediatric residency at Boston Children's Hospital and Boston Medical Center, and you were accepted into a fellowship program with then-Senator Hillary Clinton's office, and you were asked to focus on two areas, children's health and environmental health. Tell us about that fellowship program and what you did there.
So I had the privilege of working for then-Senator Clinton for a year after my pediatric residency, and that's really how I got excited and enthused about environmental health and its influence on all our lives and the ability to do something about it to help us all. The average medical student gets between 1 or maybe 3 hours in their entire curriculum of environmental health training. So suffice it to say that coming into that experience in Capitol Hill, I did not really have much knowledge or insight into the impact and the profound impact that synthetic chemicals can have on people's lives. And so when I had the privilege to focus on these issues, I became really enthusiastic and excited, and that really started my career path studying this now for 2 decades.
I was interested to read about this because I guess I didn't know that senators have these kinds of fellowship programs.
The fellowship program was organized by Boston Children's Hospital and the Dyson Foundation. Senators do host fellows through a variety of programs. The most famous group of programs is through the American Association of the Academy of the Scientific Academies. But there are a variety of organizations that organize these programs, and they provide great opportunities to expose people from professions and other entities to aspects of public life that they otherwise wouldn't get. And I count myself lucky having had that set of experiences.
And you say that when people go to medical school, you get between 1 and 3 hours on environmental health. When we've had doctors on, they've said the same thing about nutrition, that you just don't really take many classes on nutrition. But that is starting to change. Do you think that this is also starting to change, that medical students will learn more about environmental health, just given how ubiquitous these chemicals are and what we now know? We now know more about their effect on public health.
It's frightening to think that I spent multiple surgical procedures holding retractors for open heart bypass surgeries as a medical student, compared to what little time I had for environmental health. But there's a lot of hope in that the millennial generation has already woke to the concept of climate change, and that's providing an opening for discussion in a much more open and upfront way about the reality that there are environmental and other preventable causes of disease and disability that can't be prescribed away, if you will. We're used to thinking about medications or surgeries as the major ways that we can treat patients, but all too often by the time these conditions arise, it's really just stemming the tide or buying time to manage a condition rather than actually prevent it and improve people's lives in a long-term way. And that's what I'm delighted to support here at NYU in a variety of ways. We work very hard to get environmental health into the first-year medical student curriculum so that all students, whether they're going into surgery or primary care, get that insight from a very early stage.
You have been studying endocrine disruptors for 20 years now. Why did you decide to write this book now?
Well, I like to say that endocrine disruptors affect 99% of us, but less than 1% of us know about it. And the moment that really this crystallized for me was coming back from work we had done to advise the European Union about the disease burden and costs of endocrine disrupting chemicals there. Unfortunately, for us in the United States, Europe has led the way in proactively intervening to prevent these exposures. And yet they have disease burden that costs Europe $209 billion, €163 billion if you use the right exchange rate, each year. And that was an estimate based on less than 5% of endocrine disrupting chemicals, a subset of diseases due to a subset of those chemicals, and then a subset of costs due to a subset of diseases due to a subset of chemicals. So suffice it to say, that was an underestimate of an underestimate of an underestimate. And yet, already €163 billion is 1.2% of Europe's gross domestic product. So coming back from that work, the large costs of endocrine disrupting chemicals, the annual costs of these endocrine disrupting chemicals, really stuck with me and got me thinking about the reality that the costs could even be greater and the impacts could even be greater here. Take, for example, the use of flame retardants, which has continued until very recently when California changed a law that required flame retardants be added to furniture starting back in the 1970s with good intentions to stem the tide of fire. But the reality is that we've had a legacy where in the United States we have flame retardant levels that are much higher for decades, a generation of children, if you will, that have been exposed to chemicals that are toxic to thyroid function. And ultimately, with thyroid function being so important for a child's brain development, ultimately impairing the ability of children to succeed in school and in society. And then you look at chemicals used in cosmetics and personal care products. Europe has banned nearly 1,500. The U.S. has banned 11. And that speaks to some of the serious differences. And I often say that policies lead to differences in exposures. Exposures contribute to disease, and disease costs us all. You look at the U.S. costs of endocrine disrupting chemicals, and they're much higher, $340 billion a year. That's 2.3% of our gross domestic product. That's an annual cost. insofar as these exposures continue at current levels. So that combination of events really drove me to write this book, because it was high time not to just have this sit in dusty books or prints on the bookshelf. I really felt strongly that all of us need to know about this increasing threat.
Let's repeat what the fact that you just shared with us. In the chapter, What's Going On, you write, since 2003, Europe has banned 1,300 chemicals from cosmetics that are known to cause cancer, genetic mutation, reproductive harm, or birth defects. In 2006, Europe enacted regulation called REACH, Registration, Evaluation, Authorization, and Restriction of Chemicals, that requires chemicals commonly found in personal care products, carpeting, clothing, and food be reviewed for potential health effects and, if necessary, be replaced with safer alternatives. In comparison, the United States Food and Drug Administration has banned or restricted only 11 chemicals from cosmetics. So 1,300 in Europe and only 11 in the United States. Can you talk about, we've talked about this many times on the show, but this number has not changed in how many years in the United States? 11?
30 years. Wow. Since it's been 11 chemicals banned in personal care products for 30 years, whereas Europe, literally, that number increased by over 50 in the past couple of years.
And we've talked a lot about the influence of the chemical industry. What do you think explains this? Why is the number in the United States so incredibly low? And there's so much more research out than obviously there was 30 years ago.
All too often, we hear the argument that the safer alternatives that exist are too costly to consider. But the reality is that the costs of diseases due to endocrine-disrupting chemicals run in the hundreds of billions of dollars. And even if you reduce that by 1, 2, 5% or what have you, that speaks to large economic benefits to society of these safer alternatives. And the safer alternatives can cost much less than the numbers that people throw out there. The reality is that when you create a market for safer alternatives, you create a market for companies to innovate and develop cheaper and more reliable substitutes that don't have the same health consequences or profiles of toxicity that raised the initial concerns in the first place.
Let's talk about what we know about these chemicals. I mean, you write, we realize that though the chemicals themselves are often excreted within a few days, they leave lasting effects. And I think this is really important, because when we did our show last week about the Dirty Dozen from the Environmental Working Group, our guest said, and studies show this, that if you eat a lot of fruits and vegetables with chemicals, like non-organic, and you get blood tested, you're going to have a lot of chemicals in your body. But then if you eat, let's say, organic for a month, 2 months, those chemicals leave your body. But you write that even though that happens, these chemicals leave lasting effects?
That's why it's so important to prevent these exposures at time points that are crucial for children in particular. So we often say you can't rewind a child's brain development, and that's true. Pesticides and brominated flame retardants in particular are known to disrupt thyroid function in pregnant women, and the fetus relies on thyroid hormone from mom until at least the second trimester of pregnancy. And if you disrupt thyroid hormone in that earliest phase of development, there are crucial opportunities to have healthy brain signaling that are lost, and you can't rewire that child's brain development. It's known that children who have improperly functioning thyroid hormone during pregnancy can develop profiles of not just cognitive deficits, but autism even, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And unfortunately, studies have now shown that proximity to pesticide spraying may actually increase the risk of autism, not to mention other studies that have shown differences in IQ levels among children exposed to flame retardants and pesticides, but also magnetic resonance images, images of the brains of children highly exposed to pesticides that have specific and different differences in their brain development that correlate with the psychological testing.
You write that other effects include lower IQ, obesity, type 2 diabetes, infertility, fibroids, low sperm count, testicular cancer, heart disease. I mean, the list is very long. Autism, as you said, breast cancer. And then to add to that, you write that flame retardants, plasticizer chemicals, bisphenols, BPA, we see so many BPA-free labels out there now, and the bisphenols are used to line food and beverage cans. And then pesticides can have long-term impacts, not just on the people who are exposed to them, but you write that they could even be passed on to the next generation. Can you talk more about that?
So let's start by talking about chemicals that contribute to obesity. The science here has really accelerated over the past two decades, suggesting that synthetic chemicals in the environment can make us fatter. There's some 50 synthetic chemical obesogens that are known. Now, none of this changes the notion that diet and physical activity are the major drivers of the obesity and diabetes epidemic we're experiencing today. But we know that chemicals like bisphenol A can literally make us fatter. Bisphenol A makes fat cells bigger. This disrupts the function of a protein that protects the heart lining called adiponectin. And it's a synthetic estrogen. So in a sex-specific way, it can have serious influences on body mass, especially during puberty and other windows of brain development, of organ development. In addition, a category of chemicals called the perfluoroalkyl substances or the Teflon-like compounds have actually been found in adults to unravel the successful weight loss through diet and physical activity. They followed a population of adult men and women who had lost weight through healthy diet and physical activity, and before watching them to see what they did after that weight loss, they measured their perfluoroalkyl substances in their serum, and they found the higher the level of these Teflon-like compounds, the more they gained that weight back. And then when they looked for a mechanism by which this was occurring, they found that the perfluoroalkyl substances were associated with a slowing in the metabolic rate. Literally imagine a thermostat being shifted the wrong way to literally burn less weight off after having a healthy diet and physical activity intervention. So literally that dial of the thermostat the wrong way literally made this population of adults regain the weight that they had worked hard to lose.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Leonardo Trasande. He's the author of a new book, Sicker, Fatter, Poor: The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future and What We Can Do About It. Dr. Trasande is Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the NYU School of Medicine at NYU's Wagner School of Public Health. And if you have any questions for him about chemicals, we'd love to hear from you. What do you do to limit your exposure and your family's exposure to harmful chemicals? If you're a parent, what do you do to limit your kids' exposure to these chemicals? Despite the BPA ban, it is still in use in cans for vegetables, beans, even beer, and we'll talk about that in a minute. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. So Dr. Trasande, let's stick with BPA for a couple more minutes. So the FDA issued a federal ban on the use of BPA in baby bottles and sippy cups back in 2012. But despite this ban, BPA is still in use, as you write, most notably in the linings of cans used to store vegetables, soda, beans, and beer. Now, I've noticed that on so many cans these days, it says BPA-free. If a can does not say BPA-free, should we assume that there's BPA in the lining, or how do you get that information?
There may not be BPA in the lining, but unfortunately, we're realizing that there are some regrettable substitutes that have snuck in after the BPA-free movement. So instead of replacing BPA with a chemical free of health consequences, many of these BPA free cans have one of 40 bisphenols, such as BPS, BPF, BPAP, to name a few. It's almost an alphabet soup of chemistry there. But just focusing on one of those bisphenol replacements, BPS, we know that BPS is as estrogenic and as toxic to embryos, suggesting that they may have as much health consequences as BPA does or did in the first place. So because we've not taken the step to ban these chemicals as a class or get rid of them as a class, we have a situation where we're literally playing chemical whack-a-mole, where we are we have one problem, but we're replacing it with another.
And are these companies using these chemicals to make the food last longer? I mean, why are they using them in the first place?
So bisphenols are used in cans to prevent corrosion of the cans. The good news is that bisphenols replaced lead as anti-corrosive agents. So I suppose it's good that they got lead out of these cans, but the problem is they replaced it with a group of chemicals that are hormonally active and ultimately contribute to disease and disability. Among the outcomes that are associated with bisphenols are obesity, cardiovascular risk, learning disabilities and dysfunction, not to mention difficulties with ovarian function in women. So what little we know suggests a host of consequences across the lifespan.
As you were writing this book, the Food and Drug Administration released findings from a large-scale study of BPA called Clarity, which argues against the notion that BPA exposure is a problem, especially as a food contaminant, basically arguing against what you just said. The FDA and industry studies paint a picture that BPA is not a problem, while, as you say, the academic studies raise very serious concerns. As a doctor and a parent, Dr. Trasande, as someone who spent many, many years researching these chemicals, what is your reaction to this FDA study?
The point of Clarity was to achieve clarity, if you will, about the differences in studies between academic laboratories and industry, as well as regulatory entities like the FDA. For many years, there were a lot of concerns that the academic laboratories did not use what are so-called good laboratory practices. There are methods that were used and implemented because industry had been falsifying its toxicity testing data, whereas that had not been a problem with the academic laboratories. In practice, the scientific differences really have not borne out, and even the FDA's own data that they use in support of suggesting that BPA is safe suggests low-level toxicity of these chemicals to the animals and tissues they studied. The relationships between exposure and response just don't fit the mindset that FDA has taken for many decades now about how chemicals can be toxic to humans ultimately. The science has just accelerated leaps and bounds, suggesting that the dose doesn't always make the poison. And unfortunately, the Food and Drug Administration is still taking that mindset, setting aside study after scientific study that suggests serious consequences, even from the FDA's own data.
Well, if you'd like to join us with Dr. Leonardo Trasande, author of Sicker, Fatter, Poorer, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Patty in San Francisco. Hi, Patty. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, yes. I've always wondered if the possibility of exposure to chemicals back in the 50s either when I was in my mother's womb or in my early development is the reason why I'm trans today.
Well, we know that a number of synthetic chemicals can be active as sex hormones. The implication of that for individuals is still not clear. We don't have the human studies to really identify whether that's or those chemicals are contributors. It's clearly a concern that needs more research.
All right. Thank you for that question, Patty. Let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for this. A couple of comments. One, I was exposed in the 90s to a chemical called toluene diisocyanate. It's sort of a ubiquitous chemical used in construction work. It's on the state Prop 65 list in California, but in California, all they do is put up warnings if you're lucky to see a warning. And so that's one issue. The other one that I wanted to talk about was plastic containers that you were talking about. I just recently bought some sauerkraut that's in a plastic container that says no BPA at Whole Foods. And I called the company, and I've done this with other companies too, about their products and asked them specific information about, well, if it's BPA-free, what kind of plastic are you using? And I can tell you, trying to get this information out of these companies is like pulling teeth. I mean, you're lucky they're going to fall back on its proprietary, we only have 1.5% or whatever. It's 99% clean. And I'm just, it's really amazing that they can dodge even asking or answering simple questions like that about what is in your product. And you're lucky if you can get that information.
Well, think about the kinds of conversations that would occur 20 years ago or 10 years ago. And I would say they were few and far between compared to the conversations we're having now with companies about the use of these chemicals. There's been substantial momentum. Just look at recently two major supermarket chains that were identified as having perfluoroalkyl substances in their buffet-style food packaging and other food packaging. And in response to a study of five containers, you saw on Instagram and other paths of social media changes where the supermarket chains literally shoved aside their stock of these containers and replaced them right away. They insisted on their upstream suppliers to change their practices. You can argue that that wouldn't have happened 10 or 20 years ago as people in the general population are becoming aware of these chemicals as issues for their health.
Well, thank you for calling in, Greg. Today we're speaking with Dr. Leonardo Trasande, author of Sicker, Fatter, Poorer, The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future and What We Can Do About It. And we'll get to more of your calls and emails after a short break. This is your Calls One Planet series.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. If the lines are full, which they're filling up right now, you can send an email to yourcall@kalw.org. You can leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio. It's all about Game of Thrones on 1A, coming up in a half hour here on KLW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will hear from women with incarcerated loved ones. One in four women and nearly one in two black women has a family member in prison. A new aerial dance performance from Flyaway Productions called The Weight Room explores the damaging impacts of having a loved one behind bars. We hope you can join us for that tomorrow. And if you'd like to join us today, we are speaking with Dr. Leonardo Trasande. He is Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the NYU School of Medicine at NYU's Wagner School of Public Service. He's out with a new book, Sicker, Fatter, Poorer, The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future and What We Can Do About It. We have an email from Lorraine who says, most times I do not buy organic due to cost, but I do wash all fruits and veggies that have edible skin in white distilled vinegar and water. I soak for 20 minutes and then rinse well, and then I let air dry. Does this help?
Well, unfortunately, it doesn't help any more than just washing off with plain water. Study after study has tried to take conventional produce to evaluate how to get rid of pesticide residues, and unfortunately there isn't really a straightforward method. That's why the best step here is to purchase organic if possible. Now, there are priority fruits and vegetables for which eating organic is most important. The Environmental Working Group has come up with a dirty dozen that you've profiled last week that identifies the fruits and vegetables. They are typically the ones where you eat the outer layer of the fruit or vegetable, and that's where the concern is greatest about the pesticides staying on the foods and getting into your bodies.
And it's a kind of an incredible, Dr. Trasande, and one test, they found 80 pesticides on one strawberry.
Well, that speaks to how many pesticides are used right now with relatively little understanding of the consequences for human health. There's been a lot of progress, I should say, in the United States with regard to regulating pesticides until recently. The U.S. government has probably one of the best food protection acts called the Food Quality Protection Act that adds an intentional safety factor for pesticides to protect children. Unfortunately, the execution of that law right now has not been as consistent with the science or the intent by Congress. You may be familiar with action by the EPA not to ban chlorpyrifos, an organophosphate pesticide well known to be of concern for the impacts on kids' brains due to economic and other concerns just about a year ago.
Right. Well, thank you for the email, Lorraine. And you can find that show, if you'd like to spend more time learning about pesticides on fruits and vegetables, at yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to David in Redwood City. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I just want to ask, you know, with all the chemicals that we're exposed to, both in the air and what we intake, when our bodies are so sore, like fats and whatnot, do those stay in our body, and when we lose fat, does it actually, does our body have to process those chemicals again? And also with the body load, like, what is the natural process of our body getting rid of these toxins?
David, the last part of your question, can you repeat that?
I just want to ask, like, what is the natural process of our body getting rid of these toxins and poisons? Like, if you're exposed to something like Roundup, does your body hold on to those toxins, and does that, you know, cause the cancer? Or, like, just, like, you know, like, how does our body, can be excreted through our sweat, through our, you know, like, how do we actually get rid of these toxins?
There are multiple ways. Thank you, David.
Yeah.
There are multiple ways we excrete these chemicals. Some is, as you said, literally through sweat, but more often it's through our liver processing them and depositing them into bile and ultimately excreting them through our gastrointestinal tract, but also the kidney plays an important role. It really depends on the individual chemical. There are a group of persistent organic pollutants, which are used less and less now because they've gotten a lot of attention, but they're the ones that can deposit without being excreted as readily, let's say, in fat or other body compartments.
And is there anything else we need to know, Dr. Trasande, just about how long these chemicals stay in the body, who's affected the most? I mean, is there any way to really answer those questions?
Well, as we talked about at the top, many of these chemicals have their effects because of timing. Even at the lowest levels of exposure, a developing child or even someone older in the lifespan can have an exposure that can put an imprint that can have permanent and lifelong consequences. The science has also taught us that chemical exposures can leave imprints on our genes, not in the genomic code, the AC, G, and T, but in signals on the genome that can literally change how those genes are expressed. And those epigenetic changes, as we call them scientifically, can get passed not just to the first generation down the line intergenerationally, but even two or three generations down through what we call transgenerational effects. So it's not just the effects in the person who's exposed that we're concerned about. It's the next and subsequent generations that are also of concern.
And since David brought up Roundup, I just want to ask you quickly, Dr. Trasande, what do you think about the recent court rulings? Just 3 days ago, a French court ruled that Monsanto is liable for a farmer's health problem. Here in the United States, we have seen two cases. Here's a headline from NPR. Roundup maker Monsanto ordered to pay $80 million in damages to a cancer victim. This is a 70-year-old Edwin Hardison, whose lawyers argued that the glyphosate-based herbicide was a substantial factor in causing non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. He's a Sonoma County man here in California, diagnosed in February 2015. What do you think about these rulings?
Well, they speak to the impact of that the court system can have in stemming the tide of chemical exposures when the evidence gets to the point of precipitating lawsuits and such. What I would ideally like to see is a system that proactively identifies these chemicals before they're used in the first place and focuses the effort on screening these chemicals before they're used and before we have a legacy that then reverberates for decades or generations to come. Unfortunately, with a chemical like Roundup, the potential for lawsuits is the tip of a proverbial iceberg. Just to comment for a second about GMOs and foods in particular, one of the benefits of eating organic is that you avoid any herbicide exposure in foods and get the benefits of avoiding the even better studied pesticides that are impactful on brain development as well as other consequences for human health.
And on that point, we have an email from Joseph who says, can you talk about the dangers, if any, posed by the pesticides that are permissibly used on produce labeled organic, especially pyrethrins? It's P-Y-R-E-T-H-R-I-N-S.
Generally speaking, and this can be followed up offline, the synthetic pesticides are not permissible for use under the USDA organic label. What are allowed are some of the natural pesticides that have been tried and true, tested over longer periods of time. It's not to suggest that they are completely free of health consequences, but they are known to be free of some of the consequences that we know occur from the organophosphate and other pesticides that can impact thyroid function and ultimately children and their brain development.
Well, thank you for the email, Joseph. Today, we are joined by Dr. Leonardo Trasande, author of Sicker, Fatter, Poorer, The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future and What We Can Do About It. Dr. Trasande is Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the NYU School of Medicine at NYU's Wagner School of Public Service. Let's hear next from Mo in Richmond. Hi, Mo. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. So my question is, are there any substitute chemicals that are, I guess, healthier for you, for people, that academia has suggested to the industry?
There's a lot of progress in the world of sustainable chemistry, such that safer alternatives have been increasingly developed. And in fact, they don't have to be more costly than the chemicals currently used in products. So take, for example, BPA, which we talked about in aluminum cans. So oleoresin is a naturally derived alternative. It's not perfect for all canned foods, but it can be substituted. And the cost of oleoresin is on the order of 2.2 cents a can. So we actually did a study back in 2014 where we looked at a hypothetical in which we eliminated BPA exposure from cans as a result of substituting oleoresin and looked at the benefits and the costs. The cost of oleoresin is roughly $2.2 billion across the 100 billion cans used each year, whereas the benefits of preventing obesity and adult cardiovascular risks are on the order of $1.7 billion or more, suggesting that even based on a conservative estimate of just two of the disease outcomes known to be influenced by BPA, that you could actually have net benefits to society simply by substituting with one or more safer alternatives.
Well, thank you, Mo, for calling in. Let's go next to Shawnee in Oakland. Hi, Shawnee.
Hi. Sorry. Let me take the speaker. Thank you, Dr. Trisante, for coming on the show. The information you are sharing is really interesting. One question I have, and I'm not sure if you're able to answer it or not, but I'd like to know if you have done any research or can speak to the safety of the ingredients used in immunization.
Yes. So there have been many more studies of the chemicals used in immunizations and the effects of immunizations on children. And time and again, they've not identified any effects on cognitive outcomes or autism, which has often been raised as serious concerns. In contrast, though, we have evidence that air pollution, pesticides, and other chemical exposures can damage the developing brains of children and are more likely contributors to autism. So as much as it pains me each day, I see a family who is having to deal with additional educational and other needs for and supports for children with autism and other developmental disabilities, I'd love to see a greater focus on some of the chemical contaminants, the synthetic chemicals that are dangerous and unnatural exposures and more probable contributors to autism than vaccines. That would really be a great step forward to reducing preventable episodes of these lifelong conditions.
And that just speaks to the importance of the media really digging deep and putting a spotlight on these chemicals to raise awareness about what's happening. What do you think of the media overall and how they cover these issues?
Well, the reality here is that we've reached a point where synthetic chemicals that scramble our natural molecular signals have a 99% or more probability of contributing to one or more conditions. So the parallels here to climate change are quite substantial, except that maybe climate change is 7 or 10 years ahead of endocrine disruptors. But we're in a similar place. And when you look at the media and how it typically presents new study information about these chemicals, the reality is they give, for lack of a better term, equal time to both so-called sides in the debate, where in the reality is that if it were really based upon the scientific reality, it would be much more representative of the reality that these synthetic chemicals are costing us all as a society.
Well, thank you for calling in, Shawnee, and I hope you can stick around for the next 5 or so minutes of the show, because we're not going to end it without telling you what you can do to limit exposure for you and your family. So thank you for calling. Before we do that, let's take one more call. Let's hear from, is it Dinah or Dina?
Actually, it's Dina. Thank you.
Oh, hi, Dina. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested in a very controversial subject about the PFAS issue on coatings on pans. Also, I wanted to mention that I visited the USDA library in Maryland, and you could see everything that's allowed in the growing of organic foods. And it's quite astounding, the list of what's allowed to be put on organic crops. I mean, it was astounding to me. But anyway, back to the PFAS issue.
Well, PFAS are a motley crew of chemicals that have received a lot of attention because of contamination that is affecting communities in 20-some-odd states across the United States, and that's just based on what little we know, with levels in the water well above the levels that are likely to be safe for human health. It's almost as if we're dealing with hundreds or if not thousands of of Flints across the country with this water contaminant. What we know about perfluorocarbyl substances is that they don't just literally turn down the body's thermostat. They can also affect thyroid hormone, which is important for kids as well as adults. One of the safe and simple steps one can take to reduce these exposures is by avoiding the use of nonstick pans. It may take a little bit more effort with cast iron or with stainless steel, but simply using a little bit more olive oil or some other ingredient to decrease the sticking can avoid the use of these chemicals in the first place.
Well, thank you, Dina. We had another email about these also, and we did an entire show about DuPont, the history of these chemicals, and what we know about human health. And so you can find that at yourcallradio.org. Let's take, I think, one more caller, and then we will talk about what we can do to limit our exposure to these chemicals. Let's go to Jean in Berkeley. Hi, Jean. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, Jean, can you turn your radio down?
Yeah.
Oops, I'm still getting a... Let's try it again.
Okay.
Jean?
Yeah.
Sorry. You know, I'm hearing an echo. Sorry about that. You know, why don't... We'll see if we can fix Jean's line. And in the meantime, Dr. Trisande, let's talk about what we can do to limit our exposure to these chemicals. I mean, as someone who's studied this so extensively and has written this book, what would you say concerns you the most at this point?
Well, the great news here is that there are safe and simple steps we can all take to limit the exposures of greatest concern. So we already talked a little bit about the perfluorocarbyl substances and ways to limit exposure, but let's talk about bisphenols, for example. So avoiding canned food is a straightforward way to avoid all the bisphenols in the first place. As you can tell, I'm not necessarily a fan of bisphenol A or BPA free. Also, thermal paper receipts are a substantial way by which you get bisphenols from contact with the skin, especially for handling in the cashier register, and also into our mouths. There's subconscious hand-to-mouth behavior, and that's a second and important route of exposure for bisphenols, especially in adults. When it comes to avoiding phthalates, chemicals we haven't talked about as much here in the program today, chemicals that are found in cosmetics, lotions, and food packaging, it's important to watch what plastic containers you use with food. In particular, the numbers to avoid that are recycling numbers, there's a recycling triangle in each plastic bottle, are 3, 6, and 7. 3 is for phthalates, which not only can disrupt metabolism, but also disrupt the male sex hormone, which can be important for not just sperm production, but even sexual function or potency. 6 is for styrene, which is a known carcinogen, and 7 are for those bisphenols that we talked about. In addition, we get lulled into the notion that there's such a thing as microwave-safe plastic, but the reality is that there really is no such thing. The microwave safe label was meant for gross misshaping or warping of plastic that would occur with heat. But at a microscopic level, the polymers that make plastic break down into monomers that ultimately get into food and into our bodies. Also, it's important to avoid machine dishwashing with the harsh temperatures or abrasive chemicals that can microscopically etch or scratch the protective layer and ultimately break it down and lead to greater absorption. Also, if it's obviously etched or scratched, it's time to throw it away. Just a moment about cosmetics and personal care products. There are two words usually to avoid: phthalates or PHTH words and the word fragrance. But it's even simpler than that. There's an app that Environmental Working Group has called Skin Deep that provides some really helpful guidance that can allow you to read QR codes or labels without having to need a PhD in chemistry to figure things out. We've already talked about eating organic and about the priority fruits and vegetables. I just want to emphasize that this doesn't actually have to break the bank. Studies even in California and low-income populations, have identified decreases in pesticide levels through successful dietary interventions as well as other changes in lifestyle to reduce exposure to pesticides in children and in adults. In addition, when it comes to flame retardant chemicals, we haven't talked a lot about carpeting or furniture. So California changed the law back in 2013 not to require flame retardants be added, and they actually added a requirement on the label to document the presence or absence of added flame retardant chemicals. And so besides reading the label to pick and choose which furniture, pick and choose furniture that doesn't have flame retardants, this doesn't suggest that you have to throw out all your current furniture at home. The flame retardant is sprayed into the upholstery. That's where it ultimately is sprayed, that is intended to prevent the spread of fire. But if it's obviously not torn or scratched, that means there's a relatively intact layer around it. It's when there's actually a tear that you can have leaching of the flame retardant in a much more substantial way. Also, given that there are dusts from other persistent organic pollutants that can populate in the home, it's important to air out the home. Just opening the window for 1 or 2 minutes each day can recirculate the air with the outdoor air that doesn't have as much of these chemicals in the first place and limit exposure. So none of the steps I've outlined here really have to break the bank or require a PhD in chemistry.
And one more quick question. I think a lot of people are wondering this. One listener said, what about buying products such as beans and tomatoes in box packaging instead of a can? Can you avoid the chemical exposure then?
Tetra Paks have much lower levels of bisphenols and have much fewer concerns about the chemical contamination from contact with the food packaging.
All right. Well, thank you for that email. And Dr. Trasande, we got so many phone calls and emails, so we would love to have you back so we can go more in depth on things like phthalates, for example, and talk more about personal care products and so many of the other issues in your book that we did not get to touch on today. Dr. Leonardo Trasande is author of Sicker, Fatter, Poorer: The Urgent Threat of Hormone-Disrupting Chemicals to Our Health and Future and What We Can Do About It. Dr. Trasande is Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the NYU School of Medicine. Dr. Trasande, thank you so much for your work, and we'd love to have you back. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'd be delighted.
Great. Thank you. And you can find more information about Dr. Trasande's work at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Leah Cesarine, our intern, and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.